This is the best album ever, a part of the Overthink Podcast Network. I'm your host, Ben Helms, and today we continue our journey together in search of the best album ever. And you know how this works by now. I have guests on the show, and they tell me why a certain album should be considered up there with all the greatest albums of all time, and then we dive as deeply as possible into that album, into the artist, the track list, their influences, that kind of stuff, etc. So my guest today is one of my best friends, Brent Peterson. I've known you 10 years plus. I don't even know at this point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, a member of the Overthink family, one of the hosts of West Coast Bias, a sister show on the network. And yeah, one of the biggest hip hop head rap influences on me personally. Yeah, thanks for coming on the show, man.
Dude, it's my pleasure to be here. I'm a little nervous, to be honest with you, because you know, picking an album like this has been pretty awesome to research, but it's also kind of nerve-wracking to be talking about something other than sports. It's kind of weird.
That's true. We could talk about Steph Curry just kind of off the cuff forever. Oh, yeah, but yeah, we're trying to dive into.
Yeah, I might bring him into conversation at some point.
Oh, we should. We definitely should. Yeah. But yeah, so you have a contender. We're going to talk about that for a long time tonight, but you have there, you know, your contender you think is up there with the greatest albums of all time. So, So far in the show, we've had a rock album, a weird kind of rock album from the 80s, concept album.
Yeah.
We've had a hip hop album, rap, and this is another hip hop rap album. So we're not going to compare this directly to Lasers, but I'm sure, you know, it might come up here and there. We talked a lot about Kendrick on that album, so on that episode. But yeah, all of those previous three albums really surprised me. And when you told me your shortlist of your four or five albums that you were picking between last week, I was kind of awestruck because they're all, the list was like a historically great, like critically acclaimed. It was like the opposite of the first three where the case isn't so much like, oh, you're going to have a tough time making a case for this, but it's really going to be more like, we're going to have a great time jumping into this thing because we both love this album. Mm-hmm. But yeah, let's start off with what criteria you used to narrow down the field to get to those three or four albums and then kind of finally how you pick between them to land on this album and what you ended up picking.
For sure. And like, just so our listeners know, officially the album that I chose is To Pimp a Butterfly by Kendrick Lamar.
I do try to like do it in like a secret way, like, oh, how did you get there? And we like, it's like a surprise. Okay. But I realize if they've gotten 5 minutes into the episode, it's probably on their phone at this point.
Yeah. Well, I know it's in the title that when you have it. So
it doesn't really work as a surprise.
Got it.
But yes, To Pimp a Butterfly, 2015, right?
March 15th, 2015, to be specific. Oh, there you go, actually, yeah.
So how'd you get there?
Man, well, first of all, it was a long ordeal. when you asked me to do this, I was like, I have no clue. I have no idea. And I think I mentioned like five albums and eventually had to whittle it down to, you know, maybe two or three and then finally down to my one pick. But I think that this has kind of been a couple years coming. I mean, overall, like you said earlier, I am a huge rap album, hip hop guy. Mm-hmm. And the last few years, actually, since about 2014, I've really been into old school hip hop. More so than anything. And I've been into Tupac a lot before. He's still my all-time favorite artist. But I've really started to get into like kind of the roots and the origins of hip-hop, you know, Afrika Bambaataa, Big Daddy Kane, a lot of way back in the day guys before evolving into the 90s with, you know, the NWAs, Digital Underground, Tupac, Biggie, Nas, everybody else before getting into what was kind of a rough...
All the stuff we weren't allowed to listen to when we were alive, when they were alive.
Exactly. I was not allowed to listen to this music. Like, I had to sneak into, you know, when I was going to bed, I had to sneak on my radio. There's an old sentence.
Yeah.
Listening to Cube 93 in Seattle so I could listen to hip hop. You know, that was back when I was first hearing about who this Eminem guy was. And like, that's when I first like really started to fall in love with it.
My first rap album was Dr. Dre, nice. 2001.
Nice. You reference that album so a lot, like how much you love it. Yeah.
So much, dude. I'm still obsessed with that album. And I have been ever since the day my buddy snuck it to me.
Nice.
I didn't buy it. I burned it from a friend and like hid it from my parents.
Yep.
And
Same thing.
My gosh. Which I mean, it shows our age and also shows the homework we have to do to kind of make up for the fact that we missed the 90s basically and the 80s in rap. And so since then it's been kind of doing homework to make up for that.
And you know what the funny thing is that I think in our heyday, I would say like basically like when you're in high school and college is when I feel like it's when your real musical like prowess or affection really grows. And I think that during that time, during that period when I was in high school all the way through to college, really rough 8 years for hip hop, really rough. Like you're talking like artists like Nelly and yeah. like Young Jock, and like these guys that like have like these singles, but it's not deep hip hop. It's not something right. where I
it was party hip hop.
It was party hip hop, kind of a poppy tone to it. A lot of singles, it's stuff that you didn't really find to be like influential or able to have a real conversation about. It was just something that let's go to the club and dance to the song.
Yeah.
Which is something I did not do right. high school through college at all.
Right. Right.
Same. So, and it's fun to kind of talk about this album today because I feel that this is an artist, Kendrick Lamar, who upon the release of Good Kid, Mad City back in 2012, I feel is kind of this resurgence, this change in the hip hop game. I certainly perceive it that way. I don't know if that's historically accurate, but I do feel that when that album came out, that was a turning point in the genre of hip hop.
Yeah.
The crazy thing, and you mentioned this earlier about like the listing all the albums that you had before the previous episodes. I feel that this album actually is not even a hip hop album. I find it like almost like multiple genres. And I didn't realize yeah. that until I dug deeper into the album and kind of looked at like the bits and pieces of both the background music, the influences that he had, the different styles that he brings. It definitely has a hip hop flow to it because I honestly don't think there's a better artist in the game right now as far as flow goes than Kendrick Lamar. Maybe Eminem is close, but I think Kendrick Lamar still takes the title for right now. But this doesn't, it kind of defies genre. It transcends it.
Oh, totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot going on with this album musically and mm-hmm. it all locks into Kendrick and the fact that he has like a different voice per song. In some songs he totally. Has three or four different versions of himself.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it has this voice encoder thing where it like drops the pitch. Sometimes it has harmonies. Sometimes he's whispering. Sometimes he's screaming.
Yep.
And all the music is just as diverse as all that. It's fast. I mean, the instrumental to this album would be,
oh.
I wouldn't say just as listenable, but I would listen to it on repeat for sure.
Yeah.
It'd be fascinating.
It's actually, and to kind of go off of that too, there's even a song that has, where I learned this like after seeing this, I'm like, oh, that makes total sense. It kind of brings the tone into effect here. There's okay. even a song on the album where he talks in a higher pitch on purpose to make him sound more youthful. I mean, I like it. It's amazing. His voice in this album is incredible.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He definitely sees his voice as an instrument and not just the thing to spit lyrics out of. Yeah,
right. When I don't know the full definition of a rap image, I'm trapped inside the ghetto and I ain't proud to admit it.
Institutionalized, I keep running back for a visit. Hold up. So I first heard of Kendrick, I think I was definitely late to the game. It was after Good Kid, Mad City. It was in 2013
okay.
when that Big Sean song, Control, came out, right? It's the Control verse. We all know it now.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was, I think that's when a lot of people heard of it. That's how I sleep at night, at least. That's when a lot of other people...
Gotcha. Yeah. It's an incredible verse.
It wasn't just me, Brent.
Yeah, that's fine. As a matter of fact, I actually, if anything, I was late to hearing the song Control. I don't think I heard Control until maybe a year or two after it came out. I'm serious.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It was one of the songs that was like the internet. I remember Twitter blowing up when it happened. So it was one of the, not the first, because it was like 4 years after I got Twitter, but it was one of those moments where whoever it was tweeted it out and it just like blew up and I was like, all right, I have to listen to this.
Right.
And I went to YouTube or whatever it was, and it was like this super, it's like a 3 minute long verse, it's like 60 line, whatever it is, like it's and it's just him ripping apart the rap world. When she watching the kids, I'm in a destruction mode. If the gold exists, I'm important like the Pope. I'm a Muslim on poke. I'm Machiavelli's offspring. I'm the king of New York, king of the coast. One hand, I juggle them both. The juggernauts.
Even the person who is the main artist on the song, he ripped up everybody.
Yeah, yeah, and it was. I mean, he drops the line Machiavelli's offspring in that,
yep.
which I didn't realize for a couple years after that until I started actually getting into Kendrick. And that was, I realized that was the first time that the world was kind of introduced to him being Tupac's offspring, basically.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Like the reincarnated Tupac, which is a theme all throughout the album that we're here to talk about.
Yep. Exactly.
And yeah, I definitely thought that was just like, oh, it's a cute comparison. He wants to be like Tupac. And then since then, it's been like, oh, no. He might literally be Tupac.
Yeah, it's very much deeper than that. The crazy thing about it too is that it's definitely generational. It's not like he followed up immediately after the bookend of Tupac's life and his overall like highest existence point in terms of his music career. But it's mostly like it took like almost 20 years. You know, Pac died in 96, and in 2012, though, you know, Kendrick released a couple albums even before Good Kid, Mad City in 2012. It's almost been a generation, so it definitely feels that way. Like it's a like you said, it's an offspring of Tupac.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, look at Dre was a producer on this album. Snoop is on the album. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are kind of contemporaries with Pac, and they are definitely, it's weird seeing rappers in their, like, twilight of their careers, because they're still rapping all the time, but, you know, it's definitely, they're not in their prime or whatever. I guess. So it is a different generation for sure. Totally. Maybe a couple generations later, like you were saying earlier.
And even in like, and even in 2011, I don't know which, what concert it was, but there was a concert where Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, and I can't remember who the other artist was, kind of anointed Kendrick the new king of hip hop, the new king of LA. Wow. Like he was the one ascending to the throne.
I was very late to the game.
And to have a guy, I mean, like including Snoop Dogg, obviously, who's a very historically, has a very long career, very legendary career, has some legendary albums. Dr. Dre says that, you believe it.
Yes.
So,
right.
Yeah.
That is true. Mm-hmm. He knows stuff. So yeah, getting back to Pimp a Butterfly, mm-hmm. it won a million awards, I think, roughly.
Roughly, yeah.
It won Album of the Year on Rolling Stone, Billboard, and Pitchfork. It was mm-hmm. nominated for Grammy for Album of the Year and won the Grammy for Best Rap Album.
Yep.
Won a bunch of awards for the singles, different videos that are basically like small movies. If you know any of Kendrick Lamar's music videos, they're all amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And live performances won some. Yeah, it was certified platinum earlier this year, actually, which means it sold over a million copies in the U.S. mm-hmm. and much more outside of the U.S. It's basically, it's a concept album, right? Which, oh, to me, totally. Concept album sounds like a weird, like, Rush album that's about, like, alien abductions or about, like, Lord of the Rings or something.
No.
When I think concept album. But, yeah, this is concept album in a much more accessible, real, mm-hmm. topical way. I mean, this... He talks a lot about Trayvon Martin. He yep. talks a lot about Ferguson and just and police brutality and things going on in the world today. And that's one of the main concepts for the album. I think the other concept would be one that I picked out, and I'll obviously throw it to you as well, but kind of the duality mm-hmm. of what it is to be human, specifically the duality of Kendrick.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. good versus evil. And yeah, a lot of that. Kind of what do you take away from that? Or what's your concept of To Pimp a Butterfly as a whole? What do you think of?
That may be the most loaded question you could possibly ask me about this
album.
Let's get
into it.
I feel like the term, like my first thought when you said it's a concept album, like what's the concept? Like which one do I pick? Because like you said, sure. there's so many different things that we could choose from. And that's why I find
that are overarching over the whole thing. Yeah,
completely. I feel that this is a story that it's a deep story. This entire album is. That takes us to many destinations, and those many destinations are the concepts. So why I feel like this is the best album ever, because I feel that it's something that you can refer to like a story, but you can go so many different places. Sometimes art, you know, and when it comes to art, you have, you know, it's in the eye of the beholder. You can interpret it as you want, but there's so many different interpretations that you can have of this. That's why we're having a conversation about it right now. I mean, it's like this just deep art album. But I think that the overall like concept I got from it was the duality part for sure. This is coming off of his most successful album ever and a hugely successful album period, Good Kid, Mad City, which was basically his ascension, his I'm going to work hard to eventually achieve my dream. And so this is kind of the perfect sophomore album to that because the freshman album had all of these perfect things that came together and everyone loved it. Now he has a couple years to deal with the response to that album. And that's what this sophomore album is. So he's able to take all of the, I guess you can call them temptations that are coming at him from everywhere, including not just his family and friends, but from the music industry, from the government, women, everything else that comes with that. So this is kind of his overall battle with trying to stay humble and trying to stay at his roots, trying to be a influential rapper who is, like you said, kind of the offspring of Tupac while also staying true to Compton. So that's the kind of the main concept that I really got overall from it.
Yeah, and in the first song, he mentions the in Wesley's theory, he talks about your horoscope is a Gemini, two sides.
Mm-hmm.
There's two sides to everything, and there's this self-indulgent side and there's a self-control side. There's depression, which he gets into, and there's a party mm-hmm. inside. There's a shallow and a deep side. There's mm-hmm. the caterpillar and the butterfly, which again goes into a lot. Obviously, the name of the album. Originally, I read this today and it blew my mind. I saw an interview with him where he revealed that the original album of the original name of the album was supposed to be To Pimp a Caterpillar.
Oh, really?
Or 2PAC, Tupac.
Oh my gosh.
But he's like, that's a little too on the nose. And plus, he didn't want to be Tupac. He wanted to transcend. He didn't say this, but my read from that, what I infer is he wanted to transcend what Tupac was saying.
Yes.
And as Danny said on the Lupe episode, the last episode of Best Album Ever, that Pac's his favorite guy. He rides and dies for him. But if there's one negative thing about Pac, it's that he wasn't deep enough. Mm. And that's kind of where Kendrick excels in, is thinking deep into every single character that goes onto the page when he's writing lyrics, right? Every single thing has three different meanings. There's levels to it, you and I know, you know? So it's just, it's crazy. Even the name of the album has like three different meanings.
Right, yeah, it totally does. Yeah. I remember when I was in college, I got really into Tupac. And one of the things that they talked about with Tupac is how there was a lot of that, I guess you can call it duality, a lot of like kind of a internal struggle with himself and everything else, where he could be one of the most well thought out, compassionate, understands the perspective of everyone, including both the rich and the poor side, because experienced both of those. But at the same time, he could be so volatile, and someone who obviously dealt with a couple instances of breaking the law and got caught up in awful situations and stuff. Like it's something where like he was constantly confusing almost his audience because of the different feelings that he gave. In one album, you could have so many different sides, and it almost became something where like, well, I don't understand the overall what he's going for here because of the fact that it's so different.
Yeah.
Whereas, that's one thing that I would kind of take another comparison with Kendrick and Tupac. By the way, the Tupac thing the T-Pac thing that you mentioned earlier, To Pimp a Caterpillar, that blows my freaking mind. I did not notice that.
I know.
There was a few times I even wrote down the phrase, T-P-A-P, and never even thought of T-P-A-C.
Right. I was like, oh, too bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's close, but it's not that.
I can't believe that. That's crazy.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. Okay. Wow. You blew my mind, man. I'm trying to regather my thoughts after that. That's crazy. I love it.
There's a lot of words on this album that not only can we not say, you know, on this podcast, even though this isn't really, you know, this is an explicit podcast. It's fine to swear occasionally, but as two white dudes, not only do we not feel comfortable saying that, but we aren't the best people to be addressing some of these issues. And so we probably won't cover every single issue covered in this album, obviously, in this 45 minutes to an hour or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, certain things we don't feel comfortable talking about that maybe we'll have people on eventually on the Overthink to talk about. But yeah, I guarantee you this album will be on another Overthink episode. As soon as I told Jason that we were doing this, he was so jealous.
Yeah. I know.
I think because if I'd asked him first, this might have been his album.
Oh, was it? Oh, seriously?
it might have been.
Sorry, Jay. I'm sorry that I took your album, man. That sucks.
I'll have to pick another one. Okay. Or not be on the podcast.
Yeah, for sure.
So let's go back to personally. When this album came out, do you remember the first song you heard? Do you remember, did you sit down and listen to the whole thing? What's your kind of personal journey with this album?
I remember listening to this album. I have this weird thing with my mind, by the way, where I remember exactly where I'm at or where I was in life whenever I listen to any album or read any book. It happens to me.
Wow.
I can tell you, I have a, you know, a huge room full of books, where I could tell you exactly what year and what month I read that book in, because my memory just works that way. So the same thing with music, where I remember driving home from work one day and I had to go to my parents' house for some reason. I think I had to pick something up or I don't know what it was. And that's when the album came out. It was in March. And I remember listening to it on the way to my parents' house. And I remember actually not liking it at first.
Wow.
No joke. I thought that Good Kid, Mad City had more of a kind of musical flow / influence that I was used to, which was like the music from the streets, because that's what art is imitating life here. He's coming from the streets, and that's the music that he put out in 2012. 2015 became this, like you said, it's the concept album. It has a lot of 70s funk influence with it.
Yeah.
And something which I know not very much about, nor do I really like get into that much. So when I first heard it, I thought it was okay, which is like insane to say now. But it's the truth. It's how I felt in the first time I listened to it. The only song I really remembered when I was listening to it were actually two, where it was King Kunta and Black of the Berry. Those are the two songs I remembered, period, listening to the album. But I mean, like, as I actually listened to it again a couple times, and it's, you know, Kendrick in general is one of those guys where you listen to it the first time and you have to kind of acquire the taste for it a little bit. It takes a couple listens. I think
it's not the most accessible. Yeah,
exactly. And I even wrote that down. This is not a very this sounds crazy to say as my best album ever. It's not a very listenable album, actually, because it's not something that you pop into your car and you're driving down the 5 or I-5, whatever, and you're listening to it and you're just jamming. Like, it's not one of those kind of albums. It's got so much more meaning to it than just that. So that's why it was really tough for me at the beginning to listen to it. But after like listening to it again and again and again at different stages of life and different contexts where I'm like, I'm in my room by myself, or I'm with my buddy who can talk about hip hop with me. Like all these, when I hear all these different things, all of a sudden I pick up more than I did the first time. So that's kind of where I was at as far as like the origins of this album.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason that Lord of the Rings won like novel of the century or whatever for the 20th century. I mean, it's not the most accessible book,
right?
But it's one of those that you can't go deep enough into it. Like the deeper you get and the more you want to understand, there's more appreciation,
right,
and more desire to understand even more, which is 100% what I get when I experience this album. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, let's just jump in. Let's go through the track list then. And if we need to speed up towards the end, we can do that.
Sure.
I think initially just kind of in my personal side or whatever of the album was, I knew, obviously, the song I was, I think, the first single. Maybe All Right was the first single.
I'm pretty sure I was the first single, yeah.
Sorry, that I heard. Yeah, I think I was the first one. And then All Right, whenever I go to it, I'm like, why is I like the 15th track and All Right's like halfway through? And mm-hmm. I'm like, he doesn't know how to put this album together at all. And when I sat down with Genius.com and like went through the whole thing, like line by line, I was like, oh, I get it. There's an order to this mm-hmm. whole thing.
Totally.
So,
yep.
All Right, for free. A lot more jazzy, kind of, I think free jazz yep. is the exact genre, but it's like crazy drum beats, crazy horns going on.
Fast keys, man.
Yeah, man, yeah. It's just very disorienting. Pretty quick song, I think 2-minute song. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it builds up to the last like 24 lines of him just going on.
Mm-hmm.
Just like going crazy lyrically. Pushing my check with less endorsement, left me dormant, dusted, dude, disgusted, forced with fuck you
fingers and more shit, porcelain pipes, pressure, busting twice, choices, devastated, decapitated. You know, I wondered actually about this song a little bit when I was listening to it again, and I'm wondering why, I still wonder why For Free actually may have been, why was it not the first song on this album? It's kind of like, it's not a criticism, okay. It's just kind of like, I'm wondering why he chose Wesley's Theory first. And I think that the lead in is like musically is great because it has this slow crescendo at the beginning of the album.
True.
That part is perfect, whereas like the actual song itself, I think For Free should actually be the first song on this album, because I feel that For Free is actually the two, even though those small, short 2 minutes actually encapsulates what the album is. This is what the album is going to be. Okay. It's something where, there's juxtaposition, there's duality, there's the extended metaphor, everything else is laid into these 2 minutes, and it's a brilliantly fast. And like you said, it's a free-flowing song where the fast keys, the jazz drums, everything else. But he also raps insanely quick on it too. And it's just kind of this awakening. Like you're about to hear something or go somewhere that you haven't been before.
And I wonder why that is. Yeah, you're right. Because it does have a lot of the same stuff of the same themes of the entire album encapsulated into a really small intro-like song.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if musically or lyrically he felt like Wesley's Theory was more of a bridge to previous albums, and maybe it was more like transitioning the listener in. Maybe I don't know. That's maybe more of a question for you or for Kendrick. We'll have him on next week and we'll talk about it.
I feel like that's a pretty specific transition, though. It's like this whole concept of tax protester theory, you know?
Yeah,
that's
true.
It's super specific, and even references a specific actor's name and everything.
Yeah.
But I mean, I can see your point though. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I mean, and For Free ends with the line, "America, you bad bitch. I picked cotton for you and made you rich. Now my dick ain't free,"
mm-hmm.
which is very specific and literal, and you know, saying to me like, "You got all this work for free. You got all my success. People are riding off of my coattails.
Yep.
And now it's time to pay up."
Yep.
And that's kind of what the next song, which is it was my original favorite. It's my current favorite, King Kunta. And if I got a brown nose for some gold, then I'd rather be a bum than a motherfucking bum. Oh, yeah. Bitch, where you and I was walking. Now I run a game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs off. King Kunta, black man taking no losses. Oh, yeah. Bitch, where you and I was walking. Now I run a game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs.
And it's this idea that that we can be kings as entertainers, but at the same time, people are still asking us, or the industry is still asking us, would you rather have your foot cut off or your balls cut off?
Yep.
That's pretty much. So what's that? Those are your options. What do you want to do?
And this has a instance kind of like Control did, where he says, "I can dig rapping, but a rapper with a Ghost Rider, what the happened?"
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically talking about. It's interesting how he had Dre two songs ago, and he used mm-hmm. to be a Ghost Rider for Dr. Dre.
Yeah,
and he's been a Ghost Rider for a lot of guys, and that's basically how Dr. Dre raps now these days. But a lot, you know, he said in an interview that he's talking specifically to young rappers coming up, that's more seen towards, hey, like when you're coming up, like write your own stuff, like show what you're worth, show what skills you have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was less like, if you have a ghostwriter, you're not a real rapper, and more like, let's see who you actually are. If everyone's ghostwriting for everyone else, then we don't know what you actually sound like. We don't know what your thoughts actually are.
Yep. I've got a bone to pick, he says in the first line of the song. I got a bone to pick with the music industry and lesser rappers. That's pretty much what it is. Why you should not be ascending my throne. That's my throne.
Yep, yep. And this is also the first song that has the start of the poem that he reads during Mortal Man at the end.
Yeah.
So it kind of, as if anyone who hasn't heard the album is listening to this, go listen to the album and then come back.
Totally.
Not that there's any like spoilers, I guess. Feel free to keep listening. But four or five songs throughout the album, he ends the song with reading a couple lines from a poem that he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
That's talking, I think it's a poem to Tupac. Is that how you read it?
I think that in general it is, yeah, because it's the it's the beginning of their dialogue. So it kind of introduced the discussion that they were going to have at the very end. I found it kind of interesting, actually, that it's like he released certain parts throughout the album. So that's why it kind of builds on the aspect of it being a story. But at the same time, each line that he revealed, I guess you would almost call it like, it's an outro, but you would almost call it like a footnote of like, this is what
like
this song was.
Almost that repeats and builds.
Totally. And when it builds, the part that's built on, or the, I would say like the actual like bricks and mortar of the part that was just built is what's going to occur next. This is what I just gave you again, you know, what this song was. Now it's leading to the next song. And here's the layout for it.
Made me want to go back to the city and tell the homies what I learned. The word was respect. Just because you wore a different gang color than mine's doesn't mean I can't respect you as a black man.
Forgetting all. So I thought it was a perfect way to kind of transition between songs, because it gave the entire album this flow to it. And it was really cool to hear more and more of it as the album goes on.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
So we could literally talk about all of these songs for like 20 minutes each.
Yeah.
Like 30, 40 minutes in now. So, so let's do like a quick summary of a couple songs until we get to All Right. We'll break down All Right, because it's obviously a big single. So
totally.
The fourth song, Institutionalized.
This song is actually the song that I, when I first like actually fell in love with this album, because I saw him perform this. I can't remember where it was. If it was like the MTV Video Music Awards or BET Awards. I don't remember which one it was, but.
And it's about the BET Awards.
I mean, he actually performed this song with chains on. Like, I don't know if you remember this. He walked on the stage with chains on. But I mean, yeah, it's just a story about someone who's just dazed and confused. He's very talented, but still under that neighborhood ruse, and someone who wants to get out, but wants to stay at the same time. Kind of that internal struggle that he has as a rapper.
Yeah, and then him ending it with saying, you know, shit don't change until you get up and wash your ass.
Mm-hmm. From his grandma.
From his grandma. Yeah, my grandma says exactly. So it's basically saying like, yeah, you want success? This is crazy. You think I forgot what it's like to be, you know, to grow up in Compton?
Mm-hmm.
Work for it. That's what I did.
Exactly.
Which is a rough lesson, but there you go. Five, These Walls.
Mm. A lot of melancholy in this one. A lot of guilt, but still braggadocious. Are the words that I wrote for this one.
Yeah, that's like a good, those are good adjectives for who I think of Kendrick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like braggadocious, but also.
A lot of guilt.
A lot of guilt, exactly. Yeah. Not always humility. Obviously, Humble's the big single, right, for this year. But like, it's not always humility. He's definitely proud and braggadocious, but. Mm-hmm. But guilt in there. There's some darkness at the same time always.
Oh, in general, though, like it's called These Walls because these walls can actually have a couple different meanings. It can mean the walls of a prison cell. It can mean the walls of his own mind and conscience, like kind of like where he's battling his own internal thoughts. And also, and I know that this is not necessarily a family podcast, but it also can mean the walls of the inside of a woman's vagina. Like it's got all these different aspects to it. It's like all these different experiences where, that braggadocious side comes out along with the whole guilt of like being in prison for example, but also like the overall depression that he really does feel and in his own internal thought.
All right, you, track six.
You, by the way, I don't know if you saw this this quote that he had, but he said to, I don't remember who it was to, but he said, this is one of the hardest songs he's ever had to write.
The video looks like it.
Yeah, and he actually, this is like the antithesis of I, along with yes, Black of the yeah. Berry, actually. But yeah. I thought one thing that I want to pass along with this is like also kind of a depressing song that he actually describes as helpful, even though it is depressing. A producer on the album actually said that was in the booth with him, or in the studio, I should say, with him, saw that with this song, he was Kendrick was writing it in the booth. And while he was doing it, he was pacing back and forth for the whole time. And he said he was furious. He was angry. And what they decided to do, or what, I don't know whose idea it was. I don't know if it was Kendrick's idea. I thought this was brilliant. He asked, or someone asked for the lights to be turned off.
Oh, wow.
And so he recorded the song in the dark.
Jeez.
And he wanted to basically like summon that feeling, that emotion of being in the dark, of being by yourself, of being lonely. Right. And then having that internal struggle with yourself, like loving you is complicated. You know, that's loving himself is complicated, and turning to the bottle is sometimes his answer. But in general, like it's kind of this self-loathing song, and it's very depressing to hear.
Yeah, and the video is depressing to watch or tough to watch because mm-hmm. it obviously has all of those themes in it, and it's him in this little room with a decanter of alcohol, and it's slowly mm-hmm. getting smaller, and him just like cry singing half the song and screaming, and like it's. Yeah, loving you is complicated. I mean, that could easily be the name of the song as well. It could be the name of the album. So
it's true.
Yeah,
true.
Yeah. Loving you is complicated. Loving you is complicated. Loving you is complicated. I place blame when you steal. Place shame when you steal. Feel like you ain't shit. Feel like you don't feel. All right. Oh, that was not on purpose. But all right. Track number seven, the single. I think this to me more so than I is. The song that I think of when I think of this album as far as the singles.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the introduction of Lucy or Lucifer mm-hmm. into the album, which is, again, another theme that comes in throughout, which kind of personifies evil and temptations, materialism, kind of the trappings of success, right, throughout the album. It could also be drugs, that kind of stuff. But yeah, this one, if you're wondering where Pharrell was, he was on a Kendrick album because he's everywhere else as well.
Uh-huh. All right. Alright, nigga, we gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright. What you want? You a house, you a car, 40 acres and a mule, a piano, a guitar, anything. See, my name is Lucy, I'm your dog. Where do I start on this one?
There's a lot going on. A lot going on.
This song also kind of encapsulates a little bit of what this album was. This album isn't a corporate album. On the contrary, it's a damn riot. And this song is kind of like the anthem for that riot. And
became that, yeah.
It did. It actually became a literal anthem back in 2015 when basically at the height of Ferguson, but this is also coming off of, and by the way, a lot of influence of this album in general also came off of Trayvon Martin's murder. And yes, so you combine that along with Ferguson, you talk about just brutality towards black males in general. This song said, it's kind of like almost on that. He's trying to make it a more angst filled, we shall overcome. And this actually became a chant that people used in the 2016 elections. I think I'm pretty sure it's decently well known that Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton were kind of the candidates that the black community was more on the side of when it came to the most recent election. And I don't know if it was much said at Hillary gatherings, but I know that at a few Bernie gatherings, there were groups of people, both black and white, who would chant out the term, "We gonna be all right. We gonna be all right." And that was based off of this particular record. So I find this is the perfect song too of art imitating real life and people trying to have their voices heard. This is the anthem they want to use to get that message across.
To me, compared to the first six songs, this is like from the get-go a radio hit. Like it's this happy, like easy to bob your head to. The lyrics are really catchy. It's gonna be all right. Just sticks in your head for days. It's like the rare uplifting positive, not rare uplifting, the rare positive song. Throughout, even though there are dark themes throughout the song. Obviously, he brings up Lucifer. But yeah, I mean, it's a song that's talking about police brutality, but it's talking about not the fact that, like, it's okay, but it's going to be all right.
Yeah. Yeah, like, exactly.
So we will overcome, exactly like you were just saying. And then he gets more into the personal stuff with Lucifer and having all of these stuff and temptations. And then the poem ends with the next section of the poem is, I didn't want to self-destruct. Mm-hmm. The evils of Lucy were all around me, so I went running for answers.
Right.
And that's when we get to, well, actually, he performed this at the BET Awards in 2015. So when the album came out that same year.
Mm-hmm.
And Geraldo Rivera, Fox News, I don't know if you knew this, he got outraged about something.
Whoa, Fox News got yes, wow.
It's pretty shocking. It's
okay.
Pretty shocking.
Okay.
But he said it was a disgusting performance, criticized him,
yep.
Said that the quote was, and this was in the news, I remember, yeah, and the real news, not Fox News, hip-hop has done more damage to African-Americans than racism in recent years. Thanks, Geraldo. But yeah, so...
That actual clip is used in the beginning of the Damn album. So.
That's what I was going to mention, yeah. So I love his response was, oh, I'll take that and I'll just put it in my album.
Yep.
Yeah.
Kendrick's response I thought was perfect because it's the concept of art imitating real life, or does life influence art?
Yep.
It's the chicken or the egg concept. And
yeah,
that's what he wrote about. That's what this song has to do with.
Exactly.
We're trying to convey this message, and the fact that you decided to choose the part that is overly negative, even though this song technically is a hopeful song.
Right.
In my opinion, I feel like this is, like you said, this is one of the rare positive songs in this album. And this one, I think its overarching idea is hope. And that's what the term all right actually has to do with hope. You're kind of in a sunken place, but it's going to be cool. Oh. In the future, things will be fine.
I mean, he used it in the intro to DNA. Mm-hmm. And it's, I wonder how much Geraldo and that comment and that whole situation had to do with him writing DNA, because DNA seems like to be speaking specifically to not only that comment, but that type of thinking.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, you're going to say that this is worse than racism? Let's dive in, and I'll tell you what it's really about. But we're not talking about Damn right now. Sorry. Let's come back.
Yeah.
of course, the happiest song in the album.
Next year,
exactly. Of course, the happiest song in the album, again, produced or co-written or whatever with Pharrell being involved. So, mm-hmm. Nice. Good job, Pharrell. Happiest guy in the world. Anyway, all right, up next, For Sale, the eighth track on the album.
I know that we've already been introduced to Lucy, which, by the way, for all you out there, I'm sure that hopefully you've got it by now, but Lucy is short for Lucifer. It's a character that it's played out. So this song has to, it kind of goes hand in hand also with For Free, which is the second song on the album.
Right,
has to do with
right.
temptation, because Lucifer is the ultimate tempter. And it kind of just talks about wealth and lifestyle and women and everything else that comes with being tempted. And that's what Lucy is really referred to as far as the overall metaphor and For Sale. Pursue me. Lucy, go get it. Lucy, not damn it. Lucy up front. Lucy got paperwork on top of paperwork. I want you to know that Lucy got you all your life. I watched you. And now you all grown up to sign this contract if that's possible.
And then we get into Mama, which is this kind of offbeat, rhythmically, musically, like it's not even a syncopated beat. It's the opposite of a straight beat. It's just kind of like random drum hits almost. And it's just kind of offbeat. And he rhymes that way too. His lyrics are like he's sticking syllables where they shouldn't be. Like lines are too long. Didn't mean that to come out as sexually as it came out. Anyway, moving on. Wow. But yeah, it's kind of him realizing the power and influence that Lucifer has had on him, and him like not only realizing that, but making a concerted effort to turn that around and like go back to who he really is, to authentic Kendrick. And in reading the lyrics, I was wondering if Mama or Mother was, it's definitely his voice of reason throughout, but I didn't know if that was a made up character or literally his mom and the words she has said repeating back to him. Cause he brings her up again, I think in Mortal Man somewhere, he brings up Mother again. And I wonder if that's again, kind of like the good angel equivalent to the, you know, Lucy, the bad angel.
Yeah.
Basically being his conscience, being the thing that is his voice of reason. But I don't know, how did you read that?
Going off what you said, it sounds like that the term Mama or this song in general has to do with returning home. And home can have three different meanings. And I think that the third one I'm going to mention is actually the correct one.
Okay.
It can actually refer to his actual mama in terms of going to his to Compton and returning to his roots. It could refer to, secondly, the pre-fame self of Kendrick, and going back to what he used to be, which is the more humble, less conflicted artist that he is now.
Yeah.
Or what I think is the correct answer with the third one, which is which actually became a huge, huge influence, especially on the last couple songs in this album, which is returning to Africa. He visited South Africa in 2014, and there's a common reference to Africa being the motherland. So mama is, you know, short for motherland. So you're returning in his overall like roots of returning to Africa, not just going beyond just his actual Compton home or his own, even his self startup,
right.
But mostly a how South Africa influenced how he thinks.
Right.
So,
and he talks about the pain of going home. And I don't know, he doesn't say that specifically, but the third verse is talking about specifically talking to a kid in South Africa,
mm-hmm.
and like a long verse about their conversation. And mm-hmm. I took away from that him not wanting to be reminded of kind of the pain of his past. And I don't know if he's specifically talking about African American past or if he's talking about Compton and like the pain and poverty that he grew up in. But, you know, again, going back to the like, I, you know, being inspired to want to do something to help people, but also being overwhelmed with kind of grieving and guilt and that whole thing that goes into to wanting to help people, right, who are in a worse off place than he is. So
he saw himself in the kid. He describes the kid very vividly and describes him as very similar to his own childhood,
right,
but yet at the same time very, very different, very, very different, yep, upbringings. And it's interesting to see kind of that perspective that he has, because he's seeing like we said, like kind of that going back to a homeland idea or a concept of what it would be like to have your roots based in Africa, or actually to grow up physically and literally in Africa.
Yeah. And if this song, we talked about, obviously has overarching themes, but I think almost like a sitcom that has like a three episode arc where Brad Pitt comes in and plays or whatever character for three. Like this definitely has a couple of those where the next song, Hood Politics, and the song after, How Much a Dollar Cost, both refer a lot back to mama, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Hood Politics being all about from different points of view, kind of talking about the different politics of getting out of the hood, right? Getting out of out of there, being successful and kind of maintaining who you are, even though you're surrounded by success. Again, those themes prevalent throughout the album. And then How Much a Dollar Cost is, we'll get much deeper into that, but is the idea of a guy, I believe in South Africa, right?
Yeah.
Some for 10 Rand, which is the equivalent of a dollar. And it's a homeless guy asking for money. And it's his internal monologue basically for three verses talking about what that is like, the guilt, the feelings, the pity, the rage that he goes through in that. But yeah, what are kind of your thoughts, either Hood Politics or How Much a Dollar Cost?
Hood Politics is kind of the zero fucks given.
Yes.
Song.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was Rap Genius or it was Rolling Stone or whoever, but they described it as kind of it was a State of the Union address is what they described it as.
Interesting.
And they even compared it to the second term, I don't give a fuck Obama.
Yeah.
So like, yep. I have, there's a huge major laundry list of temptations, which have already gone into previously in the album. And this is the song I was talking about that he delivered in a high pitch. Like this is
right. Oh yeah.
This is Kendrick. Youthful Kendrick who's saying this. So he's dissing American politics. He calls them Democrips and Republicans. Yeah.
It sounds better when he says that. Okay.
Yeah. So it's like hood politics. You know, like if you think of like Democrats and Republicans, but then you got the blue and the red, and they're going at it. You know, it's the same idea. From Compton to Congress. Set tripping all around. Ain't nothing new but a fluid new Democrats and Rep against red state versus a blue state. Which one you governing? They give us guns and drugs, call us thugs, making they promise to fuck with you. No condom, they fuck with you. Obama say what it do.
This song or this album as a whole, you get an idea of who Kendrick is and what he's trying to say.
Yeah.
If you were to just listen to this, it's a very different portrayal of who Kendrick is than the rest of the album. Because, like you said, it's a zero fucks given Kendrick.
Yep.
And that's a very aggressive... I mean, it's like the Tupac, right? If you just hear Ambitions as a Writer, To Live and Die in L.A., or I might even think of better versions or whatever, but really aggressive Pac songs, but you never hear...
Hit 'em Up would be a good one. That's a really aggressive one.
Hit 'em Up would be a good one. Yeah, exactly. Well, whatever aggressive ones, right? I mean, it's listening to the entire album where you get both sides of the story. And so it's... yeah, it's just tough how it's not really how singles work. That's not how music is sold these days. You have to listen to, you just listen to one song.
None of the songs in this album are in a vacuum. They all have their place in the album. They all have their order in the album. Yeah. That's why it flows so perfectly.
Yep. Mm-hmm. All right. How much did Dollar Cost?
Did you know that this is actually based on a real story?
I did not.
Yeah. So when he was in South Africa, he apparently was at a gas station. The song is actually more puts more in depth, and it's kind of like one of those based on a true story kind of ideas, yeah, where like my English was not understandable to the attendant at the gas station, but apparently he was approached at a gas station by a homeless man, and he remembered saying no, and the man got a little more, I don't know, like volatile, I guess would be a good word to use, but apparently was not backing down on like asking for a dollar or asking for 10 ren, which is apparently the equivalent of one US dollar. And he remembers going away from the situation feeling guilt. I don't remember if reading the story, if I remember hearing that he ended up going back and giving him money. I don't remember that part of it, but I do remember that this whole song is built off of that whole quick story. Walked out the gas station, a homeless man with a 7-10 complexion asked me for 10 rand, stressing about dry land, deep water, powder, blue skies that crack open, a piece of crack that he wanted. I knew he was smoking, he begged and pleaded.
The whole song ends with the guy saying, "I'm God," right? Mm-hmm. Which to me, growing up in the church, I think of that, you have the nice like poster board or whatever at the Christian bookstore or whatever that says like the Matthew 25:40. There's a lot of biblical imagery in this song, but Matthew 25:40, I tell you the truth, when you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you were doing it to me.
Exactly.
That's brought up a lot in the church. Obviously, that's kind of how this song ends. I think there's another, he talks about Exodus 14. A humble man is all we ever need.
Yep.
Talking about Moses. And then he talks about John 8:32. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free, where that the line in the song is, he looked at me and said, know the truth, it'll set you free. You're looking at the Messiah, the Son of Jehovah, a higher power, blah, 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 I'm God. So,
yeah.
Yeah, a lot of Bible stuff going on. It makes sense to me that someone who definitely knows his Bible well and having that experience at the gas station, it'd be easy to kind of click that to like, oh, that guy might not literally be God, but I should see him as if he is, in the sense that, like, have compassion, right? Yeah. Treat him with respect and love.
There's almost this justice aspect to it, where it's like, you denied me a $1, even though you make millions of dollars.
Right.
And therefore, that costs you a seat in heaven. It's kind of this weird, like really blunt justice that God has, and that's what he was kind of interpreting from that. And that's, I think that, like, even though that sounds insanely... well, I don't know what the term would be, but like it's, you know, kind of more of a conservative thought where it's like, if you don't do this, God's going to punish you.
Right.
I think that it kind of encapsulates his guilt because he feels that way. He feels that he's lost a seat or a crown or whatever in heaven due to the fact that he did not spare one freaking dollar of his millions of dollars that he's made.
Yeah.
Did you know this song also was, apparently it was Obama's favorite record on the album. Apparently.
His favorite song?
The favorite song. Yeah. His favorite song on the album.
Wow.
Yeah. That's what, I don't know where I can't remember where I saw this, but it was something that was revealed in Rap Genius.
I'm trying to not let that change my thoughts on the song.
Isn't it kind of interesting actually that
it's a very political song now.
I know, exactly. Isn't it kind of weird how it's Barack Obama, the first black president in our nation's history of which our biggest sin ever is slavery, but yet this is the highest positioned person in the land.
Right.
and he was and Barack was still president when this album came out and when he wrote this even. I'm sorry if that changes your outlook, but yeah, apparently that was what was revealed.
That's cool. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. You Ain't Gonna Lie and Complexion are tracks 12 and 14, and right in the middle, The Black of the Berry.
Yep.
Another one of the singles off the album. He starts every verse with, I'm the biggest hypocrite of 2015. He's a living contradiction. Again, getting deeper into the idea of that dualistic nature. But it's aggressive, right? This is aggressive Pac. Right?
Yes.
This is the beat. It has like sirens going on in the background, and it's Black of the Berry is a hard song to listen to. I'm the biggest hypocrite in 2015. Once I finish this, witnesses will convey just what I mean. I mean, it's evident that I'm irrelevant to society. That's what you're telling me. Penitentiary would only hire me. Curse me till I'm dead. Church me with your fake prophesizing that I'm gonna be just another slave in my head.
President, or I guess one of the co-presidents of TDE, which is Top Dog Entertainment, the main entertainment group. That it's a record label that Kendrick comes from. He apparently there was a post about this song where he labeled this song is to Malcolm X what I is to Martin Luther King Jr. This is the song that brings a lot of anger to it, like you say. It overall deals with this radicalized self-hatred. But yeah, this Malcolm X part, you know, comparatively to the I that is MLK.
Yeah.
The lyrics in this song, by the way, were written right after Kendrick heard the news of Trayvon Martin's murder. I don't know if you heard that.
But that was the thing that cemented in the fact that we're not going to be able to talk about this album as deeply as other people would be able to.
Right. Thank you for mentioning that, because I think that's the perfect segue into the next song, which is You Ain't Gotta Lie, which... Okay, so I'm sure you have a couple opinions about the song, but I kind of want to say that this is the song where the main idea of this specific song is that Kendrick is listening to his mom or to his mother, and in the end, he's sharing that knowledge with his peers, with his guys.
Right.
And I think that this is the song where, for me personally, like you and I have mentioned multiple times tonight already, how we are not in the same shoes as Kendrick or as other men in the black community, but yet we are still white males who I think at the end of the day need to listen.
Yeah.
We're like really listen to what he's saying. In terms of if you're the loudest person in the room, you're the weakest person in the room.
Yeah.
And you need to stop. You need to listen to what's happening. Yeah. So, and that's what this song really came down to. And the girl's gonna neglect you once your parody is done. Reputation can't protect you if you never had one. Jealousy, conflict, emotional, conflict, self-pity, conflict, under oath, conflict. The loudest one in the room, that's a complex. Let me put it back in proper context.
It's another one of the biggest singles on the album, and it's a song I can't get enough of. And it's got a very positive vibe to the music. Mm-hmm. And it's one that was hard for me to look up lyrics, man, because there's the album. It's weird, right? Because usually there's like, oh, the live version of a song or the album version. The album version is the live version. There's a separate non-live version that's not on the album. And then there's the video version.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
okay.
That's fun.
Okay. So I didn't know that.
Yeah. So yeah. I love the video. And so I watched that. And then it took me a while to realize that the album version is... it has like a part where there's like a fight in the crowd that he breaks up, and because the end of You Ain't Gotta Lie ends with kind of the crowd getting bigger, and then you know, and then I starts with him like an intro, an MC introducing Kendrick Lamar, and it gets into it, and the song breaks up kind of in the bridge where he like breaks up a fight and then does this like long freestyle, and yeah, it's fascinating that he would choose to keep that in the album version. Right. And not like use that for the video or use that for. Yeah. I don't know. What was your take on that when you heard that?
Well, I didn't know, by the way. So I'm thinking here of what you're saying earlier. It was when I was first released as a single back in, like, it was what I remember the first song hearing.
It was like fall of 2014. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I remember it being the first single that I heard.
Yeah.
Was that version in the studio? It was not considered a live performance, even though this is like, technically this song is not actually live. It kind of plays on the idea of it being live.
Right. I don't think this is actually a recording of him playing it live. Yeah. I think the version we all heard, you know, 6 months before the album came out or 3 months or whatever
was
basically the video. And it was all in the studio. There was no crowd noise in the background or whatever.
Oh, okay. Okay.
There was no like stopping to break up the fight or anything like that. Yeah. But when the album came out, I think it may have been he was just sick of the radio hit so much. Everyone had heard that 60 million times that he was like, yeah, I'll put a different version on it because they all know this version already. So that's kind of cool when I think about it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then the video is totally different.
It's completely.
Yeah. So many motherfuckers want to down me, but in a week they'll never drown me. In front of a dirty double mirror, they tell me. And I love myself. Oh, when you're looking at me, tell me what do you see? I love myself. I put a bullet in the back of the back of the head of the police. The whole thing is him saying, is struggling with depression, right? Like a lot of these songs are. It's him admitting, not only admitting, but kind of coming out and saying, this is something I've struggled with. And understanding who I am and loving that is kind of the first step in enjoying life. You can't really love anything until you love yourself and accept the fact that you can enjoy stuff. That's a huge step.
Totally.
Yeah. And then the third verse is, we're talking about, I was at war last night. I went to war last night.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends up going into this, like, the last verse goes into him having this heavily, like, low-pitched effects voice encoder version of himself coming in for a couple lines, which to me, I read, and then it kind of comes back as normal KDOT with, the last couple lines of the verse, and it ends with him screaming.
Yeah.
And so to me, it's like him struggling with that dark side of him, going constantly in and out. He can't really control it. And it ends with him screaming it, and then the next song is Mortal Man, so we hope that the good side won in that sense. But I think the idea is it's meant to be ambiguous in that neither side ever wins. It's always going to be a struggle, depression and joy, right? It's just something that you have to learn to live with, accept that it's happening and that it's a part of who he is, and love yourself. Because that's kind of all you can do sometimes.
And it kind of comes back. I know that we kind of really quickly moved past the institutionalized song, but I think that the main concept of that song, for example, it really captures what you're saying, which is everyone is institutionalized, both the poor and the rich, the powerful and the downtrodden. The powerful thing that you can do, though, maybe powerful is the wrong word, but the right thing that you can do, though, for both of those is perspective. Understand where the other person is.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, the last song on the album, Mortal Man, it's what, like 8 minutes long or something?
Oh, it's 12 minutes long, man. It's 12. It's a long one, but it's totally 12, worth it.
But it feels like 8.
I feel like it could go longer. You're right. That's true.
Yeah, definitely. When shit hit the fan, is you still a fan? Do you believe in me? Are you deceiving me? Could I let you down easily? Is your heart where it need to be? Is your smile on permanent? Is your foul on lifetime? What you know where the sermon is? If I died in this next line. Yeah, this is one of those, it's, the lyrics have got to be pages and pages long. In prepping for this, I sent you my how many words I wrote for this, and just in my notes, I wrote over 2,500 words. Yeah, just in my notes, you showed me you wrote like 8 pages handwritten in notes prepping for this.
Yep.
And I think they both pale in comparison to Mortal Man alone.
Yep.
This song is packed to the gills with lyrics, and it kind of has a chorus, but it basically kind of goes all over the place, and it ends with a poem, and then ends after that again with an interview or conversation, really. With between him and Tupac, that he very creatively and cleverly took from kind of a lesser known, I think it was Swedish, some European interview that Tupac did.
Yeah.
And he took his own questions and kind of interlaced them over, so it sounded like a conversation between him and Tupac. That if you would have told me that was a conversation he had with Tupac somehow through time travel, I would have believed you. It's pretty flawless in the editing.
All right, so let me ask you this then: do you see yourself as somebody that's rich or somebody that made the best of their own opportunities?
I see myself as a natural-born hustler, a true hustler in every sense of the word. I took nothing. I took the opportunities. I worked at the most menial and degrading job and built myself up.
This song blew my mind when I first listened to it because you know me, Ben. You know me that I'm a huge Tupac guy. I love it.
You're a big Mandela head.
And I'm a Mandela head. I've never heard that before, but thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you started it, I guess.
Wow. I felt even before this album that Kendrick was kind of the new Tupac, and this song solidifies that because even if it's something where it feels like he's doing it, where like, well, we have to anoint him the new Tupac, right? But like he's saying that he's willing to take that mantle when this song happens. So it still deals with an internal conflict, but really this song is about just unwinding the entire album. Like what did you just hear?
Definitely.
I just loved how whoever produced this song, just the weaving of the conversation of the dialogue between him and Tupac was so brilliant.
Oh my gosh, it's so good.
And Kendrick was still able to get his point across. Tupac was still able to get his point across, even though those conversations technically didn't happen together and they happened literally 20 years apart.
Right.
And it's funny to like read the lyrics is because I know that you can hear everything that Tupac's saying. It's very clear.
Yeah.
But when you actually read the lyrics, it's prophetic almost what's happening because Tupac is
Machiavelli.
Yeah, Machiavelli. He's portraying an actual bloodshed that could occur. I found that, I mean, like re-listening to that now, like in today's age of what is a new president and a new power structure, to be extremely prophetic.
Yeah, it's interesting how it's a different political climate and it doesn't feel dated. It feels prophetic, exactly what you said. It doesn't feel like
it aged
man
well.
That was so long ago. What a different America that was.
It was 2 years ago.
Yeah, it feels like it, but it also doesn't feel like, well, that's still on the horizon. It's like, no, this is what he was talking about.
Yep.
Exactly. And that was the interview, you know, Pac was talking 20 years ago. So but yeah, I mean, this is the song, like you were saying, that he wants to be not just I want to be anointed Tupac, but like I'll take on that mantle, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of rappers, you would say, I would say, like, oh, of course, everyone wants to be Tupac, right? I want to be Tupac, right? That's he's the king of rap. Tupac was 25 when he died.
Yep.
Like nobody actually wants to be Tupac.
Yep.
So the fact that he's saying, like, that's the burden I will carry, like, if it, even if it gets me killed, is what he's saying, which is, I mean, that's, yeah, that is a burden to bear for sure.
It's not a mantle that you want, but at the end of the song, or at, it's more of a, it's not really a song in its entirety, but, you know, being more of a combination of dialogue of different ideas. But at the end, he reads a poem, which is kind of like the absolute definition of what the album is, talking about the caterpillar and the butterfly.
It goes poem, conversation with Tupac, and then another poem. It's a long song.
It goes exactly, poem asking him questions about like what the future looks like, pretty much, and getting an interview, and then like, hey, what do you think of this,
right?
And and it's the whole caterpillar butterfly concept. And at the very end, he goes, what do you think of that? Pac. And there's no response. And, you know, that obviously had to do with the fact that Tupac has passed on through his murder back in 1996. But also, it's like the perfect way of saying that he just gave everyone his overall idea of what this whole entire album was, or what he's feeling at the time. And he's looking for Pac's response, and Pac doesn't have an answer. Therefore, Kendrick is the new person to take the mantle.
There it is. Man. Anything else you want to say about the album as a whole? I know we're in like minute 85, I think.
You know what the crazy thing is that we talked a lot tonight, and I'm glad that we had this conversation, because I feel like we got everything out that we wanted to say tonight. Yeah, but like in general, there's so much more to talk about. That's why I feel that this is the best album ever. There's so many parts of the onion that can be peeled back. And that's what I want art to be. I want to have all the feels. I want to have all the conversations. I want to be able to continually have it be a discussion point. And like you said earlier, it ages well. It's something that even right now, I think it's going to remain relevant for years down the road too.
Yeah, man. I'm excited to see what this will look like. Well, this will sound like in 10, 20, 30 years. But yeah, this definitely is one on the short list. I mean, it's one of four right now, according to this podcast, on the list of best albums ever. So definitely a contender. Brent, thanks so much for joining me tonight. It was a pleasure talking to you. It was a pleasure diving very deep into this album.
My pleasure, man. A lot of fun.
All right. If you like that, you can check out our other podcasts all over at overthinkpod.com. You can check us out on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at overthinkpod. And if you have any thoughts, comments, questions, concerns, feel free to email us. We'd love to hear from you. We will reply to the email. And that is overthinkpod@gmail.com. Thanks again for joining us. I'll see y'all next month.